Do you like sports? Do you like art? What about science? Giraffes? Giraffe scientists that paint rugby games? It's all available on Audible, the biggest audiobook site with the largest selection of audiobooks this side of the inner solar system. No need to use your boring old eyes anymore. The ears are the future, my friend. Why, you're using them right now. So check out Audible and get your listen on. Go to www.readlearnlivepodcast.com/audible to start your 30-day free trial today.
But the other really pernicious thing about traditions is that they provide an excuse for men who are essentially afraid of confronting other men because they can always say, we can't do anything about female genital mutilation. We can't do anything about bride abduction or bride killing in India, for instance, because it's a tradition and we are respecting their tradition. I despise that evasion so copiously.
Hello and welcome to Read, Learn, Live, the podcast about improving yourself through literature. I'm your acclaimed host, John Monaster, and I'd like to welcome you to episode 85. As always, if you have ideas for books you'd like to see featured, or have authors you want to put me in touch with, you can reach me at jon@readlearnlivepodcast.com. Today, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak with author Rosalind Miles about her new book, The Women's History of the Modern World, How Radicals, Rebels, and Every Woman Revolutionized the Last 200 Years. Rosalind Miles is the award-winning author of the international bestseller I, Elizabeth, a novel recreating the life of Queen Elizabeth I in her own words, and 25 other books of fiction and nonfiction, including the highly acclaimed Who Hooked the Last Supper? The Women's History of the World, now published in 42 languages, and the forerunner to the current work, The Women's History of the Modern World. As a journalist, Rosalind's work has appeared at leader level in major British, American, and Canadian newspapers, including Foreign Assignments. She is the only woman to have been received twice in private audience by the Sultan of Oman, and remains the longest-serving senior contributing editor to Cosmopolitan UK. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. All right, hello everyone, and welcome to the Read, Learn, Live podcast. This is your host, John Monaster, and I'm so excited today to be speaking with someone thousands of miles away, author Rosalind Miles. She's the author of The Women's History of the Modern World, How Radicals, Rebels, and Every Woman Revolutionized the Last 200 Years. I'm holding her great book right now. I had a chance to read it and found it really fascinating and a great and interesting history. So Rosalind, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you and excited to chat about this book. It covers so much, you know, and there's so much to talk about. So I always like just to kind of kick things off and get a sense of in your own words, what the book is all about.
The book for me is about why none of the revolutions of the past have actually ever worked for women and what women have been able to do about it in the last 200 years. If you look back at the French Revolution, before that, the American Revolution, women are always there, they're always active, they work alongside the men. And in the French Revolution, the women had even greater hopes of coming out as equal with the men, because of course the American one was essentially a military-led operation. You had to have the army to fight against the British. Too bad we lost your country, big mistake. So the French women were really helpful, hopeful. They were involved from the very beginning. Some people say they actually triggered, the women actually triggered the revolution, because they started the March on Versailles, which was the first time that a mass of people had ever defied the authority of the king and lived. Mm-hmm. So they had hopes which were very, very shortly dashed. The men make the revolution with the women, and then when the dust settles, it's the same power situation as previously, men in charge, women underneath, busy servicing the men in every sense of the word. And there we are back at the bottom. So this book is about the last 200 years when we were able finally to do something about that. And that's why it was such an exciting book to write.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's great. And you really chronicled that history in a fascinating way. And one of the things that I noticed about the book is that, you know, you really went at this from a researcher's angle. So, you wrote it in a very easy to read style, but you were very detailed with your notes. I mean, there's just pages and pages of notes at the end. You really took the time to make sure you got your facts right and things were clear here. So how did you develop that kind of research style? How did you move forward with trying to, you know, make sure that all these various things that you were looking at were accurately described?
Well, I was lucky enough after I left college to go to a research institute and do graduate work. And that was life or death, get your notes correct. They were far more interested in getting your notes right than actually what you were trying to say. And perish the thought, this being England, that you might say anything original or new. You just had to get your notes in order. So that was a very good training. But the other thing was that I was constantly told when I started working on women, well, there weren't any women in history, were there, dear? And quite often also in life, when in the British government, they were looking for women, in inverted commas, as if we're not all around them and under their noses, in their houses, in their beds.
Right.
But they couldn't find any women to be good enough to be promoted. And that was just so ludicrous to me. I simply would open a book and usually start at the index, looking at, say, W for women or F for female, not a difficult task, and then find out how much or how little there was there to start with. And that in itself, if there was nothing in there, that in itself told a story.
Right, the lack.
Yes. Yes, the invisible women, where were they? In fact, women are in the majority in every country in the world where they've stopped killing girl babies, as they still do in some places. If you let the women survive, they outnumber the men. And that's why it always offends me when I hear that phrase in very, very popular in Britain, women and minorities. We're not a minority, we are the majority. And in fact, the great woman Gerda Lerner, his American historian who actually began women's studies. Her first book was called The Majority Finds Its Past. And we're still finding it.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. Maybe we'll talk about that in a sec, but I also want to understand, you know, for you, how this book was different. Because, you know, looking at the back of the book here, you've done a lot. You have, you know, you've written a lot of other works. You've written novels, essays, you've lectured, you've been on BBC. So you've kind of had a prolific career up to this point. How is this particular effort different from what you've done before?
Well, one of my great philosophies of life is that for women in particular, but it applies to everybody, never say no. Unless it's something utterly disgusting, illegal, or you're just not interested. We should say yes to everything, even if we don't think we can do it. This is one of the great things we're constantly telling other women. So I would airily think if I wanted to, I could write a book about this, or I could do about, I was like Bottom in A Midsummer Night's Dream, that I thought I could play all the parts.
Right.
So I started off writing academic books. I was at the Shakespeare Institute at the University of Birmingham, where I did my first work. And I got interested in Ben Jonson, his great contemporary. But then other opportunities came up. But the more I got into everything, the more I kept thinking, where are the women? And that took me back to my childhood, where my mother was just absolutely marvelous woman, full of life, vigor, ran the house, ran the family, ran a business, was involved in the community, and everybody loved her. And There are no women like that in history until very recently. The ordinary women, she was by no means exceptional, but she and her friends absolutely carried our little tiny English market town in Warwickshire. And that's what I began to feel really like a nagging pain, almost like a toothache. Where were the women? And where are the women? Where are we still? It's a huge breakthrough that Kamala Harris has been elected as the vice president of the US of A. That was a glorious moment. We were jumping up and down here in England and drinking champagne. We are, of course, much later than you are. Wouldn't like you to think that we were kicking off with pop and fizzy stuff first thing in the morning. But that was so important. And yet, yeah. Where are all the other women? They are coming, and we'd better be prepared for them.
That's right. And finally, in terms of the creative side of it all, you know, one thing I noticed throughout the book is, you know, you vacillate a bit between a slightly more academic writing where you're describing kind of a woman or an event, something that occurred in history. But you also have a very sometimes conversational tone with the reader where you're kind of just like along with them being astonished at the kind of craziness or, you know, ridiculousness of something that might have just happened or otherwise, you know, just kind of looking at something with this interesting perspective. And so I was just curious, you know, I haven't had an opportunity to look at your other work, but I was wondering if that kind of interwoven style was unique to this, or that's something that you usually do, or how you decided to engage with your readers in that way.
I think it evolved gradually because, of course, I went to a very academic school where they were feeding 10-year-old girls on Attic Greek and Latin and absolutely extraordinary to look back on that now, because, of course, they weren't training female leaders. They were training women to be the consorts of leaders, so that if a Greek or Latin phrase went round the high table, we would know enough to laugh in the right places, but not to contribute ourselves. So I was trained in that school that history is impartial, facts are sacred, and they speak for themselves. I now know that that is a complete fiction. But even when I was writing academic books, I always knew that it was important to hold the attention of the reader. And as I developed more in my sense of where were the women, I felt more confident and indeed compelled actually to address them directly, to break the fourth wall, so to speak, as we talk about the theater, when an actor on stage addresses the audience, when the people on stage aren't supposed to know we're there. So it did seem to me important to engage them. And of course, you simply have to keep people's attention, even at the risk of sometimes saying, wake up at the back there, because if you lose them, that's it. It doesn't matter how good your notes are or your facts or anything. But you should also, I think, be honest about your point of view. It's a myth that history is impartial. We now know that. But you have to be careful to show your hand, so to speak, to make not necessarily full declaration. You cannot write, this man was an absolutely ghastly twerp and he ought to have been fill in the blank. That's not really on, because that's not measured enough. You need to be able to give a measured assessment, but also you need to be able to keep it lighthearted. You need to be able to give readers some humor and levity as you go along. It's not all doom and gloom.
Right. I think that was an important part of the evolution of the story that you told in the book was, you know, like you're saying, that, you know, things are getting better in certain ways. There are people throughout the last couple hundred years, women and men, that are working to really push forward this effort. And I think that is important, right? The idea to give people hope that they're, you know, we can keep working together for a better future.
Oh, John, that's absolutely essential. When I was a young girl growing up in this little market town I told you about in Warwickshire, I'd never heard of the US Marines. I hadn't even heard of any Marines. I didn't even know that Britain had Marines. And so when I came across the phrase, all we need is a few good men, I thought that was a feminist slogan. And I thought, yes, that's right. Because we've only got where we are with the help of a great number of very good men. Everybody knows about Mrs. Pankhurst. Nobody knows anything about her husband, Dr. Pankhurst, who was an absolutely stalwart supporter of his wife and daughters. In fact, Mrs. Pankhurst, Emmeline, said he educated her. I mean, she could read and write and think and that sort of thing, but of course she hadn't had any kind of formal higher education as he had. And she says he taught her how to think. And the men who have helped us as we've gone along, and right from the very, very beginning, the very first men, even in the Middle Ages, when it was supposed to absolutely kill women's reproductive faculties and render them imbeciles if they had any education whatsoever, there were still good men who educated their daughters and believed that the world would be better if they did. So we must always flag up the importance of the good men who've helped us. And I refrain from saying that the men who stood against us were bad men, but I leave the reader to make their own judgment.
Hmm. Yeah, just kind of present some of the facts and or present some of the information, at least, that you're able to unearth as part of your research.
Yes.
And then create and chain some of them together to create some stories, some ideas for people to think through.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. You can't tell people what to think, and you cannot, even less can you tell people what to feel. And a lot of mm-hmm. people, male and female, feel that it is the right thing that men are in charge and women are there to support them. Religions have always insisted on this throughout history. Every society is built on the premise that men are more important than women and that women are for men and should be grateful. And to ask people to reverse their previous thinking is a stretch, often way too far. I think my highest ambition would be to ask people to look at the facts as I present them. They may think I'm wrong, they may disagree, but I'm simply asking them to think. And I remember that wonderful congresswoman of yours, Patricia Schroeder, who was tasked with being a young mother when she first was on Capitol Hill. And she said airily, "I have a brain and a uterus and I use them both." And I think that's wonderful.
Right, right. Yeah. And yeah, that's so interesting that you mentioned that, you know, going very far back in time, there's this thought of the place of men and the place of women and their respective roles, and how that gets very much drilled into people so that it kind of becomes doctrine to some degree and becomes difficult to think about any other way. And so you talk about this in several places in the book, but, you know, this idea of sort of traditions or customs or otherwise just kind of the way it is as influencing people's behavior and thought, really, in the end. And I think that was a very powerful discussion that you had. So, you know, I guess how can we think about customs and traditions? Because to me, those are some of the hardest things to break, right? In terms of, you know, a lot of what we do today, even, you know, you or I, is because of custom or tradition, you know, whether that's, you know, the way that we dress or the types of foods that we enjoy eating with our friends and family or whatever it may be. So how do you think about the types of customs and traditions that were created to cause problems in this space? And how do we think about breaking those?
This is probably the site of the struggle. As a younger woman, I never got aerated, as they say in Warwickshire, if a man didn't open a door for me, or did open a door for me, or did stand up if I came into a room or didn't. And I do not regard, for instance, women's surnames as being the site of the struggle. Women in Western cultures can usually have either their husband's name or their father's name. And it's, as Shakespeare says, there's little choice in small apples. So yeah. In fact, he actually says small choice in rotten apples. But that seems to me to be the real question, how we can unpick tradition, because all traditions hold men superior to women, every single one. And traditions hold societies together. Our kind of foods, as you said, our kinds of music, dancing, religious ceremonies, burials, you name it, it's so very traditional. But those traditions are absolutely poisonous to women because they deny us the freedom to be ourselves, because they deny us the mastery of our own bodies. Look at early marriage or arranged marriage. The child's body is taken from her before she even knows what it is. Look at female genital mutilation. Look at any of these things. Arranged marriage is still widely defended as a as an honorable tradition. My view is, if you're old enough to get married, you're old enough to choose your partner for yourself. But the poison of these traditions is not simply that they all relegate women to inferior public roles, even as they exalt them in private roles. You can be the Madonna of the stove, you can be the Madonna in the household, but try and run for office, try and be prime minister. But the other really pernicious thing about traditions is that they provide an excuse for men who are essentially afraid of confronting other men, because they can always say, we can't do anything about female genital mutilation, we can't do anything about bride abduction or bride killing in India, for instance, because it's a tradition and we are respecting their tradition. I despise that evasion so copiously. I'd better get myself into a cheerier mood, or all your listeners will be switching off.
No, I think that's okay. And this is a serious topic. And I think it's really important to recognize, I think, you know, when we're, I think maybe customs and traditions can sometimes be like an invisible fence. And I think it's important to recognize when we're inside of one without realizing it, perhaps.
I regard these traditions as no other than a form of brainwashing. Take religion, for instance. When your child is born, you don't say, she's going to be a Democrat or a Republican, or she might go the green way, she might do this. But you will say she's a Muslim, or she's a Christian, or she's this or that, whatever your religion is. And that is inflicted on the child, and I would say enforced on the child, because that is the way it has always been. And that does not give people freedom to think. Now, the problem with that frame of reference is that for women, the body is the battleground. Control of our bodies is the whole cookie secret. If you make sure that women only exist for men by ensuring that they get married, enforcing them into marriage when they don't want to get married, making sure that marriage must mean wifehood, motherhood, taking care of the in-laws. I'm talking particularly of other traditions than the Western ones. Chinese women throughout history never had any identity, let alone legal identity. Their names weren't even entered on birth registers. They didn't exist. And the same also in many other cultures of the world. India has been described by the United Nations as the worst country in the world to be female. And what are they doing about it? Enforcing nationalist strictures upon one set of the population against another? It goes on. And we simply have to keep saying no, 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 as our Prime Minister, Mrs. Thatcher, was famous for saying, no, 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 stop it, don't do it anymore. We are free women, we want control of our bodies. And that's what's so wonderful about the last 200 years, that that is what happened. One of your greatest women, whom I'm sure almost everybody will have heard of, Margaret Sanger, her mother had 22 babies and died. And Margaret Sanger dedicated her life to making sure that no woman should have to go through uncontrolled pregnancy. And she was such a huge benefactor of women. Now her struggles are still being fought. The idea of birth control, her invention, that great phrase, the idea of birth control is still anathema to some sections of people. And yet, as we say in England, my choice, my body, my life.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you really describe Margaret Sanger and the fight for contraception and kind of the amazing push that she was able to make and make birth control happen in the book. Maybe just tell that story, just in case people don't know kind of the incredible, all of the incredible pieces that she was able to bring to bear and make happen here.
How she pulled it together.
Yeah.
Margaret Sanger is one of the most impressive people in the history of women's struggle, not only for what she did, but for grasping the simple fact that control of the body is the absolute main item for women's freedom. She was born into a relatively ordinary family, but her father, as we say in England, couldn't leave her mother alone. And in 20 odd years of marriage, she had 22 childbirths, which killed her. And at the funeral of the mother, Margaret Sanger flew at her father and said, "You killed her." Then she decided to become a nurse. One of her first patients was a woman who, when she was writing her memoirs, she gave the nickname Sadie Sachs. Sadie Sachs was a young woman living in poverty in New York. She was having multiple pregnancies. She couldn't afford to have an illegal abortion, so she used to operate on herself with very grave results. One time, Margaret attended her. She, Sadie Sachs, begged the doctor for some advice, some something. And the doctor replied, "Your husband has to abstain." How you tell a man like that to abstain, or any man to abstain in those days when it was part of their conjugal rights? I'm not trying to make him out to be worse than he was for his age. So Margaret Thatcher decided she was going to put a stop to all this. The next time she went to visit Sadie Sachs, Sadie Sachs was lying dead in a pool of blood, and Sanger threw her medical bag at the wall and went forward and changed the world. She was persecuted for opening the first birth control clinic. She found out about what we called Dutch caps, which were invented by a Dutch woman who drew together various other things in Holland, and they were for sale in Canada. So she would get people to go and get them in Canada, bring them into her clinic. She was closed down by the police. She was imprisoned. She suffered enormously. She was driven from pillar to post, vilified, because people believed in those days that if you used any form of barrier contraception to prevent the egg in the woman being fertilized, that was equivalent to killing a child. I don't believe many people now believe that, but that was the belief. And so she was like another very famous American woman, Madame Restel, a woman who sold birth control products. She was regarded as a baby killer, but she kept going. It was down to Margaret Sanger that we finally had the pill, because she found a wealthy feminist philanthropist to put up all the money to develop the contraceptive pill. And that was Margaret Sanger's story.
Yeah, and I really found it kind of amazing, frankly, that the story you're telling didn't really happen that long ago. It sounds very foreign, but it happened quite recently. And not only that, like you said at the end there, she had to find a wealthy philanthropist to fund all of this, because she went to all of these, pharmaceutical companies, and they weren't really willing to do it, or they didn't think it was possible, or it just seemed like the medical community writ large kind of didn't have any hope or faith in any of this.
Well, she went everywhere.
That was so interesting to me.
She went everywhere. She went to research institutes, pharmaceutical companies. But of course, the part of the problem was that in a number of US states at the time, contraception was still against the law. And it's one of the things I didn't have time to go into, but how that came on the statute books of so many states in America. You can understand why it did in the Republic of Ireland when the freedom fighter and then Prime Minister Eamon de Valera, who was a rabid Catholic, he had it put into the Constitution that this would be illegal. And we recently had a number of reforms in that country after an Indian woman, she wasn't Irish, she wasn't a Catholic, but she was having a partial miscarriage of an not yet grown fetus, and the doctors wouldn't even operate on her, and she died, a young woman. And so that triggered a review of the law in Ireland. But it's fascinating to learn how it came about in America. Because the church was not monolithic like the Catholic Church, but it was still powerful enough to have legislators and researchers and so on running scared. The church, after all, was very powerful in the American film industry. The church, a Catholic layman, drew up the Hays Code for a Jewish industry to regulate a Protestant country. It's absolutely, that's one of the things that makes America so great. You really are the ultimate melting pot, mixing pot, name it what you like. So the companies and the pharmaceutical companies and the research institutions, everybody was afraid of breaking the law, afraid of upsetting the apple cart, afraid of alienating wealthy donors who are almost always male, and really just too comfortable in their velvet ruts to want to change things for women, to want to improve things for women. Even though for many of them, if they'd had contraception, that would have improved their own marriages and their own married lives, because
right,
they would have had more control of everything.
Yeah. People tend to, that idea that they denied themselves even,
yes,
the goodness that they could have gotten is truly, truly crazy.
Another example of that I would give is that if you look at how hard every country has struggled against giving women equal pay, that was the factor that derailed the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s, when 30 out of 38 states had ratified it. Two presidents had agreed to it, Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter. They were almost there. Their hand was on the tail of the horse. With a one bound, they would have been in the saddle. But then the vested interests woke up to the fact that if women were given equal rights under the Constitution, they'd have to have equal pay. And oh my goodness, perish the thought, that could never be. But now the younger couples are perfectly happy for the women to be able to contribute to the family income. Often, if the husband loses his job or the partner, it's the woman whose money keeps them all going. And the younger men also are far more comfortable than their fathers ever were with the idea that their females can earn more than they can. They just think, right, it's all for all of us. It's all in the coming into the common pot. So it actually helps men if women can earn and bring to the common goodness and the wealth of nations, really.
Yeah, and I think that, and you talk about this, I think, in a very interesting way in the context of war in several different instances. But especially in World War II, for example, when so many of the men were, the majority of the people fighting were men, and that means that all of the industry still needed to happen, and so you kind of described this, and it was really interesting to think about. But essentially, like World War II brought a bit of a leveling of the playing field. There, women got jobs; they were being paid. That was some progress. But then after the war finished, the post-war period, there was kind of some decline again, and they were put back in their place a little bit. So maybe in that context, take us through like how that happened exactly and why, again, it sort of ended up with a retreat, like you mentioned, after some of the prior revolutions.
Well, the history of women and war is absolutely fascinating to me. In fact, I have written two books with a military historian because I always wanted to write about women and war. And they would say to me, well, Rosalind, you've written about women, but you don't know anything about war. What's the size of a battalion? And I afterwards found out that's actually a trick question because a battalion can be practically any size you like as long as it's quite big. Then I met a military historian, and he'd always wanted to write about women and war because his mother had been in World War II. She'd been in the female advanced yeomanry, the fannies as they were called, and they drove men around and did all sorts of stuff that women weren't supposed to be able to do. But he'd always been told, well, you like to write about war, you know about war, but you don't know anything about women. So when I met him, it was a marriage made in heaven. And we've published two books about women and war. And in past ages, women were always in war, in the front line. If you think about Henry VIII, for instance, obsessed with the idea that a woman could never rule, he had to have a son. His mother-in-law was Isabella of Spain, who led her own troops into battle. She not only ruled her own country, she was a queen regnant, but she led her own troops into battle and would fight in the thick of it, even when she was 8 months pregnant. So women have always been there. In the 20th century, two world wars meant greater militarization and mass mobilization. But the Western countries decided to use women as munitioneers, they were called in the First World War, making munitions. And that, of course, busted one of the cherished myths, the myth of man and machine, that men can operate all machines, with the exception possibly of the dishwasher in the modern era. But the women can't operate machines because the women did all sorts of things, making bullets and God knows what all. They also, in World War II, fought in the front line. 800,000 Russian women were mobilized as fighting forces and deployed all over the Eastern Front in particular. And so they did fight. And one of the reasons that historians now believe that the West, the Allies, managed to defeat Hitler and the Axis was because we employed our women. And in Germany, one of the first ordinances of the Nazi Party in 1921 and 22 was women may never hold any office, any public office. So when the Nazis came in, the women who'd been postmasters and stuff like that had to give up their jobs. They weren't allowed to do anything. And that is why really Hitler and the Axis powers were fighting with one hand behind their back. And in the end, as you know, Hitler was enrolling 11, 10-year-old, 12-year-old boys to fight when their women had been stuck at home. So that's why women were so important in World War II. And we've all got that wonderful image of Rosie the Riveter in our heads, that woman, we can do it. But what happened after the war was when the men came back, the fear was that the emancipation of women had gone too far. You have to remember that only in the previous century, women were still wearing corsets. They couldn't vote. They had they couldn't hold land. They couldn't own property. They had no legal existence. So that suddenly the great breakthrough meant that they were doing everything and anything. But the feeling was it had gone too far. So America led the way, really, in swinging, pushing the pendulum back. It had swung too far, and history always works like a pendulum effect. And so it swung back, pushed, I would say, not least by Hollywood. Hollywood became the Church of America, pumping out the message to women all over the country and all over England too, that your real work as a woman was to get married, was to land a bloke, get hold of a man, and that was your work, and then settle down and have children. So you've only got to look at films like Calamity Jane or any of those great Hollywood films of the time. And their greatest hope is to find a man and sort of get tamed if they have been active and free, and then, quote, settle down.
Yeah, you have a kind of an entire chapter devoted to mass media and kind of criticizing their role. So, you know, I just to broaden it even beyond Hollywood, there are so many that you talked about magazines and radio and TV and Hollywood as well. I mean, how it's interesting even to think about it before the internet. Obviously, things are skyrocketing now with the internet. But, you know, what is the role of the media in all this? How did, beyond what you just mentioned in Hollywood, how does the media continue to influence our perceptions, and how have they helped or hurt, you know, during this fight?
Well, in many ways, the internet has been what the founder of it, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, hoped that it would be, a free and democratic instrument of the dissemination of knowledge, enabling contact between human beings. And that side of it has proved to be very effective. You only have to look at the fact that, well, happening just now, with the coup in Myanmar, the first thing they do is shut down the internet. And China in particular also has got a shameful record of trying to control the internet and deny its citizens any access to knowledge and freedom of thought. But I'll just put in a quick plug here. Sir Tim Berners-Lee, the great computer genius, his mother was a computer scientist. He learned it at his mother's knee. Nobody ever knows that. Mary Berners-Lee was a computer scientist way back when hardly any men were computer scientists. And he got it from her. But we never acknowledge the role of women in these things. However, on the good side, we have to say knowledge, democracy, contact. On the bad side, we have to say peddling to the lowest common denominator, as all the hustlers did who helped to make America, like Barnum and Bailey and all those utter crooks, actually. Unfortunately, most of the internet is run by mountebanks and shysters and people who are simply interested in making a quick buck, and they don't care how they do it.
Sure.
The problem with the internet is setting up exacting standards for women, which are usually far too high for ordinary average women to reach. So it feeds a huge dissatisfaction in themselves, their bodies, their appearance. Just as an experiment, you might try this. Try paying any compliment to a woman, whatever you might say about her, you're looking really good today. nine times out of 10, a woman will say, oh, well, my hair's not, or my skin, or my thighs, or my something. They will almost always greet a compliment with some put down of their own appearance because we've been taught to be so self-critical about ourselves. If you've got a body and it works, you should be jolly grateful. You should be thankful that you are able to do all that you want to do. But the internet, this high level of scrutiny of the internet, has turned women in on ourselves. So we start picking at one another. And I also hate that thing about likes. You vote likes, that you're basically setting yourself up to be voted on with people who like you or don't like you, what you do, or, and that is just unilaterally bad.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it tends to drive people to create versions of themselves that aren't real.
That is exactly right. And the real problem is that parents, teachers, and other people either do not want to control it, or do not feel they can control it, or do not dare to control it, or else we're just all being steamrolled by the great money-making machine, which is creating such wealth that if you had 27 lives, you couldn't spend it all. And not for women, I would add. And this wealth is not created for women or by women. There are some female entrepreneurs. There are many women doing very well in business, which is only to be applauded, because business is one of the cutting edges of our society. And they will simply bring a different perspective from the men. I'm not saying better or worse, but it just rounds out the discourse. But if you look at the top of the internet tree, I leave you to make your own judgment.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, like we've been talking about, and like you talk about in your book, you know, there are so many industries that remain male dominated. And, you know, when it comes to things like starting up a company, well, if you need to get money, the groups that have the money to give out are also primarily men. And so they, you know, they tend to feel more comfortable perhaps with men. And I think that that can be a problem. And I've seen examples of venture capital firms run by women with the express purpose of supporting women entrepreneurs. And so I think there's some balancing going on there. But I think a lot of what your book talks about, especially in terms of showing us that women are extremely capable of doing all these different things, is that it's just shocking almost to see that in the last couple hundred years, how many firsts there were, that it was that society kept them from doing it for so long. And then as soon as that fell off, it turns out women are amazing at all these different things. And it's like, of course they are, they're people, you know, and as are we all. So I think your book really does a good job of pointing out whether it's, you know, becoming someone that runs a bank or becoming an adventurer that goes all over the world or whatever it might be, given the opportunity, women are as open to the task as men.
Well, that has been why it's been so exhilarating to focus on the last 200 years, because having written the women's history of the whole world before, from the dawn of time, everything that happens in the last 200 years. And as soon as women are released from the perennial tyranny of constant childbearing or being at the mercy of their biology, what they can do is phenomenal. We tend to think, well, we forget that half the intelligence of the human race, half of the entire intelligence of the human race is locked up in women's heads. And we have been so long being told that we're silly and not clever, and don't you worry about doing maths, dear. You know, our Queen Elizabeth II, her husband's mother, the Queen Mother, Queen Mary, struck maths out of the young girl's curriculum because she was going to be queen and a queen would never need to add up. And also that perennial fear that if you let a girl study maths, it would somehow damage her brain. The idea is that been so long, have been around for so long, that women are intellectually inferior, weaker, and in fact, oftentimes, we're superior. And to see women, especially in business, and especially in venture capital, as you've just said, because more women have got more money in America than in any, in their own names and in their own right, than in any other country of the world. So to see them putting it to venture capital is absolutely enthralling. And as soon as they start helping other women, as soon as women get the chance, it's like taking a cork out of a champagne bottle. Pop! It's great, yeah. Exploding cascade of bubbles and light and joy, and all wonderful. It's what physicists call the escape velocity. We've been held down for so long that we're absolutely bursting to get out now.
That's right. And so I kind of want to, you know, mention kind of the end of the book here, because you talk through all of this, all of this excitement over the past couple hundred years in terms of movement forward and, you know, gaining the vote and some elements of equality here. But you mentioned at the end that the women's revolution is the greatest piece of unfinished business in the history of the world. So, you know, what's left to do, and what do, in terms of, you wrote this manifesto for equality at the end there, what needs to happen still?
The first thing that has to happen is for the general public to accept or understand that women are not equal anywhere in the world. The fact of that a few women are making enormous progress, like Kamala Harris, like the woman who is now running General Motors, described by one American to me as the greatest insult to American manhood since Pearl Harbor, that Mary Barra is running General Motors. That doesn't mean that any idea of equality is filtering through. It simply means that a very exceptional woman has made it. And battling Bella Abzug, one of the key figures in the women's movement in America in the 1970s, said, "Our struggle is not to get a female Einstein promoted as quickly as a male Einstein. It's to get a female Schlemiel promoted as quickly as a male Schlemiel." Nobody really accepts that we don't get equal pay or anything like. When the women's movement kicked off in the 1960s, one of the first requirements, demands was equal pay. We still haven't got it anywhere, and we are not anywhere near it anywhere in the world. So that's the first thing, to accept that equality is not here and it is not happening. There are always ways of getting around it. The second thing is that we should stop talking about women's rights. There are no women's rights. Eleanor Roosevelt, your great Eleanor, who I revere and admire so much, she said, "The concept of human rights is not divisible. Women's rights are human rights. We only want what men want: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We don't want anything special." And that is not accepted at all. The other thing, which is extremely important, particularly in countries that are not governed by Western legislation, we must have equality for women before the law. We have in England Sharia courts operating, on which an item of faith is that the testimony of one man has to be outweighed by the testimony of up to four women. One woman's vote cannot anywhere near counterbalance one man's, one view, one piece of evidence. And that is absolutely unacceptable. We have no rights in many marriage situations. We cannot get divorces in many marriage situations. And we are usually punished more seriously for infractions of the law. Even in Western countries, a female criminal will tend to get a heavier sentence than a male criminal. simply because she's breaking the code, which says women should not do this. We must also insist on education for women. We have to free the female mind. Women are not getting educationally the equivalent of their brothers. And especially in poorer countries, there is still the belief that if you have any money to invest, you invest that money in the human capital of raising a boy, not raising a girl. There is a wonderful Arab proverb, actually, pour your money into your children's heads and you will always know where to find it. Now, in the Quran, the prophet does praise the education of women and he champions education for everybody, but we are not getting equality of education. And the final thing is to free the men from the idea that they have to be dominant, tough, aggressive. We're still fighting the battle of those who believe that men have to be straight. It's not so long since gay men were being killed. It was the capital penalty in Europe, although the last male that was hanged for homosexuality in England was in 1895. We're still fighting the battle. We have no gay footballers who've come out, for instance. There was one who did, and then he retired, and then there were none. They must be among them somewhere, but we need to free the men. We need to free little boys from the idea that they've got to be tough, and we need to make sure that everybody is treated more equally.
Well, hear, hear. I think that was a great list. And I hope that we are able to achieve those, and that when the next iteration of you in a, 100 years writes the next chapter of this, that there will have been substantial progress.
I am sure of that. I am absolutely certain of that. When I look back on my own lifetime, when I was a young married woman with two little children and I couldn't get a job because people were genuinely puzzled. You've got a good husband and two lovely children. What are you compensating for? That was the psychology of the time. You had to be compensating for something. If the domestic round was not enough for you, well, good old Betty Friedan put paid to that one. But when I look back on the progress that we've made just in my lifetime, I am enormously hopeful for the future. We have our shoulder to an opening door. All we have to do is to keep on pushing.
That's right. And okay, on that note, I'm going to move to our thunder round, ask you a couple quick questions, and then we'll call it a day. Sound good?
Right.
All right. What is your favorite food and or drink?
Oh, a small, elegant china plate of smoked salmon with a glass of champagne. I could eat that for breakfast, dinner, tea. Keep life alive.
Anytime. That's great. And by the way, for those of you listening at home, I think that was our third mention of champagne here. So I'm detecting a slight pattern.
Yes. It puts the fizz into life.
It sure does. That's a good slogan. Okay, question two. Where's your favorite place you've ever been?
Oh, early mornings in Warwickshire, where I grew up, not far from Stratford-on-Avon, Shakespeare country, cuckoo buds of yellow hue and painting the meadows with delight. Early morning in a Warwickshire meadow. That's where I'm going to go when I die.
That sounds beautiful. And last question, if you could wave a magic wand and change any one thing, what would it be and why?
What would it be? I have so many wishes, large and small, but the main wish for the future of the world, not simply for our sex, is to rescue all the young girls from early and forced marriages and give them an education and a place in the world. And that is the one thing that the entire United Nations, World Health Organization, everybody agrees. That is the one thing. Educate the girls and prevent them from having to get trapped with childbearing, and that would lift the entire world out of poverty. And I'm sure that will happen too.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great, great wish. And on that note, I think just we'll close it out. Thanks again, Rosalind. The book, The Women's History of the Modern World, How Radicals, Rebels, and Every Woman Revolutionized the Last 200 Years. Rosalind Miles, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Read, Learn, Live. If you liked it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. If you hated it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. And so it goes.